shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Tonight I want to talk to you about something a little bit different, and it's probably a bigger subject than we can cover in full tonight. I've spoken to you at various times before on the laws of God, including the economic laws, but we haven't gone much into how they work out in practice. So tonight I want to start in on the subject of God's economics. The economic system of the Bible, of God's law, is based upon two primary economic principles. First, that all civilization rests upon the land. Now, your own occupation may have nothing to do with farming, but you don't eat unless somebody is farming and raising the food. How many people would stay at work in Detroit making Cadillacs if the farmers couldn't provide the food? So, the primary living for everybody is from the land, and that is God's gift, His generosity. The second principle they're based upon is that the primary unit of population is the family. In the first place, it is normal for most all people to be part of a family. As their parents' family grows old, separates into the new generation families, they are forming their own families. So trying to do something based purely on the work of the individual alone is incomplete and just won't work out. You have to be able to take care of the families. We turn our back upon God and His laws and work everything backward, and we have poor results. One of the bad economic things that many people complain about is the fact that today people can get hold of vast areas of land for speculation. They don't hold them usefully. They hold them merely for an eventual rise in price and then to sell them at an enormous profit. That wasn't possible under the laws of God. God's law recognizes that Yahweh Himself is the universal landowner. Leviticus 25, verse 23, "The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, for ye are strangers and sojourners with me." All good things are given to us free by God. And that was true of the land. Yahweh instructed Moses, and after him Joshua, to divide the land among the Israelites by their families. And this was done free. Nobody paid anything for it. Numbers 26, verses 52 to 56. "And Yahweh spoke unto Moses, saying, Unto these the land shall be divided for an inheritance, according to the number of names. To the many thou shalt give the more inheritance, and to the few thou shalt give the less inheritance. To every one shall his inheritance be given, according to those that were numbered of him. Notwithstanding, the land shall be divided by lot. According to the names of the tribes of their fathers, they shall inherit. According to the lot shall the possession thereof be decided between the many and the few." So again, the door was closed upon any official favoritism. Each man got his allotment of land by lot, not because he passed a few dollars under the table to the official that was giving out the land. Now, you remember you had the census in the book of Numbers, which, as you remember, listed them by their families and the numbers of them. And so from that basis, the land was parceled out. Today, many people are so separated from the land that if they had to make a living farming, they'd be completely lost. Nevertheless, among the Israelites, that wasn't true. They lived close to the land, and anybody except the very aged, the very young, and the very sick could make a living given a few acres of land. It might be noted, by the way, that among the ancient Welsh and the ancient Britons, every man had a right to so many acres of land. That couldn't be refused him. It was a free gift from the government. So, in other words, some of the ancient Old Testament laws were carried over. You didn't get from God a title deed amounting to total ownership like we have today. We feel today that God's claim upon the land is cut off by the kind of ownership that we have, and you can do whatever you please with the land you own. Of course, we're beginning to find that you can't do anything except what the zoning committee says you can do, and they're a lot harder to please than God was. What each family got from God was a free lease upon the land. The land was evidently quite good in those days. It had not been spoiled by constant overcropping and neglect. So it was fertile enough that in that comparatively small country, it could support everybody. And even so, not all the land was distributed, because you remember when David was a fugitive trying to keep from being killed by Saul, he and his followers went out into the wilderness and hid in various places. So even in the time of David, there was considerable land that had not had to be parceled out in individual farms. All you had was the right to use that land for the support of your family. Suppose that you didn't feel you needed all of your allotment. You wanted to dispose of some of it because actually you would rather go to the city and work there as some sort of an artisan, and somebody else felt that he wanted more acreage. You could, for a time, part with your land. Or if you were forced into it by poverty, you could sell some of your land. But you couldn't sell a permanent title to it. You could sell only the right to cultivate the land and take the crops thereof, and that for a limited period only. Every 50th year was the year of Jubilee. Now, that didn't mean the 50th year from the time you sold your land. You might sell your land this year and tomorrow be, or next year be the Jubilee, in which case, only until next year is all that you could sell. And then there was another provision in there. You remember that the Roman Empire, while it was a nation of hardy, independent farmers, became a great empire, and they ruled all the ancient world that they knew about. But then there came the decay of the Roman Empire when these independent farmers lost their land. It's always true that periodically there's a year of drought or a year of insect plagues, and therefore poor crops. So the farmer, not getting enough of a crop, has to borrow money. And for that, he has to mortgage his land. Now remember, he's already broke and in debt. Then when he starts to make another crop, he's no better off. All he can do is to pay off this year's debts at the cost of going into debt next year. And so he inevitably loses his land by foreclosure. So the farmers drifted into the city to become a homeless city rabble. while a few big landowners owned enormous farms worked by slave labor. Rome reached the point where she wasn't even able to defend her own territory. She had to call on the so-called barbarians to enlist in her army and defend Rome. And when the barbarians got tired of doing that, you have the fall of Rome. Now, the law of God intended to prevent any such thing ever happening to God's people Israel. In Leviticus 25, verses 14 to 17, it says, "And if thou sell aught unto thy neighbor, or buyest aught of thy neighbor's land, ye shall not oppress one another. According to the number of the years after the jubilee, thou shalt buy of thy neighbor, and according to the number of years of the fruits, he shall sell unto thee. According to the multitude of years, thou shalt increase the price thereof, and according to the fewness of years, thou shalt diminish the price of it. For according to the number of years of the fruits, doth he sell unto thee. Ye shall not therefore oppress one another, but thou shalt fear thy God, for I am Yahweh thy God." As I said, speculation in land became impossible. What you were selling was the right to work the land and harvest the crops. And the buyer had to pay something close to the fair value of the average crops, because if he didn't, somebody else would. Having received only a temporary lease of the land until the next jubilee, the only thing he could get out of it to get back what he paid for the land was to harvest and sell the crops. The only way he could make a substantial profit was to farm so diligently that the land yielded better than ordinary crops. Well, if he did that, that was his own work, and it was a profit he was rightfully entitled to. He wasn't getting it merely by virtue of having gotten title to the land. Now suppose that the seller was in such desperate financial circumstances that he had to sell for something far below the fair value of the crops of the land. Well, that didn't put him permanently out of the running. It just made the redemption that much easier. At any time before the Jubilee, either the former owner of the land could redeem his land, or if he didn't have the money, his relatives could redeem it for him. Since what was sold was so many years of crop, they would say, "Well, you bought 15 years of crops. You've had the land 5 years and collected 5 years' crops from it. So to redeem the land, we will repay you the value of the remaining 10 years' crops that you haven't yet had." Leviticus 25, verses 25 to 28. "If thy brother be waxen poor and hath sold away some of his possession, and if any of his kin come to redeem it, then shall he redeem that which his brother sold. And if the man have none to redeem it, and himself be able to redeem, then let him count the years of the sale thereof, and restore the overplus unto the man to whom he sold it, that he may return unto his possession. But if he be not able to restore it to him, then that which is sold shall remain in the hand of him that hath bought it until the year of Jubilee, and in the Jubilee it shall go out, and he shall return to his possession." How could you determine the fair value of the land? Well, there were two things. Remember that farmers generally know pretty much what the adjoining farms are like. So if somebody had particularly fertile land, bringing in better than average crops, or particularly poor, that would be well known in the neighborhood. But aside from that, there was a general standard valuation. Leviticus 27, verse 16. "An homer of barley seed shall be valued at 50 shekels of silver." Now, this wasn't a valuation of that much barley as food. This was that much barley as seed, A Homer was about 86 gallons in our modern measurement, and 50 shekels of silver amounted to $32.50 in our modern money. So, the amount of land that took 86 gallons of barley seed to sow it, that was valued at $32.50. So you had a pretty good way of determining, as I say, what was a fair price. And the man who was trying to drive a hard bargain by saying, well, I'll pay you one-fifth of what it's worth, merely made it that much easier to redeem it from him. So he got a poor bargain. Now, today you've always got somebody scheming to corner the market on rutabagas or spinach or something or other and make a fortune out of it by raising the price. It couldn't be done then. Remember, your own allotment of land was not sufficient to do that. And if you went around buying up neighbors' farms, you'd had to pay for them what the crops were worth, so that you wouldn't be able to make any undue profit by trying to be the only one in possession of that particular kind of crop. So this was the rule with regard to all farmland, because the farmland was the family's living. With it, they had a roof over their head and they had food. And from their flocks, they got the wool for their clothing. So they could get along. Now, when it came to city property, you had a different thing. Nobody owned enough land in the city to make a living out of it. He made a living out of some kind of work. For example, he might be a goldsmith. He might be a carpenter. He might even be like Joseph of Arimathea, an importer of goods. His home in the city was simply a convenience. But if he lost this particular home, there was nothing that he couldn't do just as well in some other home that he could buy in the city. So Leviticus 25, verses 29 to 31 says, "And if a man sell a dwelling house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year after it is sold. Within a full year may he redeem it. And if it be not redeemed within the space of a full year, then the house that is in the walled city shall be established forever to him that bought it throughout his generations. It shall not go out in the jubilee." Now that was the big walled city. Now today, practically every farmer lives on his own farm because we have a reasonably peaceful land. You don't have invading armies coming through, and you don't have guerrilla bands of robbers roving around. In those days, that was not true. A few people were able to live on their land. Those who had big families and many hired servants or slaves, all of whom could be armed to resist an attack. But most of them lived in little unwalled villages and went out day by day to the farmlands to work. A single farmhouse could be easily attacked and its people robbed and perhaps murdered by bandits. But a whole village couldn't be overcome thus. So it says, "But the houses of the villages which have no wall about them shall be counted as the fields of the country. They may be redeemed, and they shall go out in the jubilee." Now, you notice that a house in the walled city could only be redeemed for 1 year. That's been carried over into our California law, that after a mortgage foreclosure, you have 1 year in which to redeem the property. Another thing that they had, in many places, in Babylon, for example, it was quite notorious, the wealthy oppressed the poor. And a poor man might have to finally sell himself into slavery to be able to support his family. Of course, at the start, he borrowed money while he could. And then, when he couldn't pay it, the creditor could have him sold to pay the debt. God's law prevented that. No debt was valid for a period of more than 7 years. It was enforceable during the 6 years. But in the seventh year, the creditor was compelled to release it. If you say, well, that's tough on creditors because a lot of people are willing to borrow who don't have much intention of repaying. God's laws, like all other laws, will only work in the hands of people who intend in good faith to live up to them. That's very true. In the hands of the select few of the best angels, a lot of systems can be made workable. And in the hands of devils, no system will work. The obligation was recognized that you had to pay off your debts in good faith, if you were able to. But a debt that proved unpayable, in whole or in part, the creditor had to cancel it. And God promised him if he would do that, God would give him such prosperity, he'd be much better off than if he tried to collect the last 18 cents from some poor, dead broke debtor. Now, that has in a way been carried into the United States bankruptcy law. When you are adjudged bankrupt, your outstanding unpaid debts are canceled. Now, only once in 7 years did the year of release come around, and you can't take bankruptcy oftener than every seventh year. So we have taken the Bible standard, in part at least. The debt itself lasted only through 6 years and was canceled in the seventh. If the debtor enforced it by suing and having, if the creditor, I should say, enforced it, by suing and having his debtor sold to pay the debt, all that could be sold was the length of time until the next year of release. This, like the Jubilee year, came regularly every seventh year. So he couldn't be sold into slavery longer than until the next year of release. And the law commanded the man who had bought him, when he has to let him go out, he says, thou shalt not send him away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally from thy fields, from thy flock, from everything. So that he, when he went back into freedom, he had enough on hand to support his family until the next year's crops that he could collect for himself. So, altogether, between the year of release and the Jubilee, you had a good protection against building up a homeless, dead broke city rabble. In the law as given by Moses, it said that you must pay each man his wages at the end of each day. They didn't have enough capital to live on their own savings till they were paid at the end of the week or the end of the month. You have to pay him at the end of the day so he can feed his family. It says, otherwise he will cry unto me and it will be sin unto you. Then you had the matter that there could be no usury. Now in our greed, we always try to tamper with God's law. And when we realize how wrong it is, then we always start misstating God's law to try to conceal what we're doing. So today, and indeed for some couple of centuries, we have been saying, well, usury is an excessive rate of interest, a rate above some allowable standard. But that's not the meaning of the word. It is a payment made for the use of money or any other thing that is loaned. A millionth of 1% a century was as much forbidden usury under God's law as the modern pawnbroker's 42% a year. Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 and 20. Thou shalt not lend upon usury to thy brother, usury of money, usury of food, usury of anything that is lent upon usury, unto a stranger, and that word meant an alien, unto an alien thou mayest lend upon usury, but unto thy brother thou shalt not lend upon usury. Why the distinction? Because God is not a Democrat. He's practical. He doesn't say you have to give the alien idolater all the benefit of the laws of God. The alien could come in, borrow, pay no interest, have the benefit of the year of release and all that, if he had to be treated the same as your brother Israelite. So, as far as the year of release was concerned, the law was that you did not release the debt of an alien. After the year of release, you could still collect it from him. And as to interest or usury, you could lend to him upon interest. Better that he go back to his own people and borrow from them anyway. Leviticus 25, verses 35 to 37. And if thy brother be waxen poor and fallen in decay with thee, then thou shalt relieve him. Yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner. Now that's not the same word for stranger. That merely means somebody that you don't personally know because he comes from a village over on the other side of the mountain. Yea, though he be a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with thee. Take thou no usury of him nor increase, but fear thy God, that thy brother may live with thee. Thou shalt not give him thy money upon usury, nor lend him thy food for increase. So, it was commanded that you freely lend to your fellow Israelite, if he be in need. And the law said, don't start thinking, well, the year of release is coming pretty soon, so I don't want to take a chance. It said, no, if your brother is really poor and in need, lend to him. Not as much as he wants, maybe, but as much as he needs. And you take your chance with the year of release. But for doing this, God will give you prosperity. Well, during Moses' lifetime, that law was kept in effect. From then on, it was honored more in the breach than in the observance. For example, after the return from the Babylonian captivity, Nehemiah tells what they were doing. Nehemiah 5, verses 4 to 13. There were also those that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tribute, and that upon our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children, and lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants, and some of our daughters are brought into bondage already. Neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. And I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words. Then I consulted with myself, and I rebuked the nobles and the rulers, and said unto them, ye exact usury, every one of his brother. And I set a great assembly against them. And I said unto them, we, after our ability, have redeemed our brethren, the Jews, which were sold unto the heathen. And will ye even sell your brethren? Or shall they be sold to us? Then held they their peace and found nothing to answer. Also I said, it is not good that which ye do. Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies? I likewise and my brethren, my servants, might exact of them money and corn. I pray you, let us leave off this usury. Restore, I pray you, to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, and their houses. Also, the hundredth part of the money and of the corn, the wine and the oil, that ye exact of them. Now they were charging just 1% interest there, and yet that was called to their attention as a great sin. So usury is anything. Then said they, we will restore them, and will require nothing of them. So will we do as thou sayest. Then I called the priests, and took an oath of them, that they should do according to this promise. Also I shook out my lamp, and said, so God shake out every man from his house and from his labor that performs not this promise. Even thus shall he be shaken out and emptied. And all the congregation said, amen, and praised Yahweh. And the people did according to this promise. Jesus Christ made it very clear that his mission was not to set aside the previous word of God. He was only fulfilling it. He said, think not that I come to destroy the law or the prophets. I came not to destroy, but to fulfill. Now, Satan's most energetic priests and assistants have never been the saloon keepers and the gamblers. They've been the so-called Christian clergymen, because they have done their best to get people away from the laws of God. They have entirely misread and misinterpreted some words that Paul said, and said that now Christ had done away with the law entirely. In most churches today, when you go to a church supper, what do they serve you? Ham. And they tell you you should eat it to show that you're not under the law anymore. And if you get trichinosis from it, why, fair enough. It took quite a while for the church to steady down from that and recognize that these laws of God were still in force. In England, the church finally held that usury was prohibited by the Bible. The first church prohibition was a proclamation by the Archbishop of Canterbury during the 600s AD. And he said it was a grievous sin for which you had to do 3 years' penance, the first year being on bread and water. Now remember, the church couldn't sentence you to jail or to pay a fine. It could only say you'd committed a sin and had to do some penance for it. It was not until 1341 that it was prohibited by Parliament. During all this period up until then, the Jews were the first usurers, since Christians were forbidden to do so. The prohibition by Parliament didn't last very long. King Henry VIII fixed an acceptable rate of interest at 10% in the year 1545. This was repealed by King Edward VI. In 1571, under Queen Elizabeth, an act of Parliament declared usury was forbidden by the law of God, in its nature sin and detestable. So they barred it entirely. In 1623, under one of the Stuart kings, James I, an allowable rate of interest was fixed at 8%. Then, when the English Revolution came and the Commonwealth was set up, the rate was lowered in 1652 to 6%. Under Queen Anne, it was lowered to 5%. Then, in the year 716, the Bank of England was officially declared by statute to be exempt from all usury laws. And for other lenders, limits on allowable interest were abolished in 1854. What good did this do? A great deal. Of what you earn, a certain portion is required to keep you and your family alive. At the end of the year, you don't have a penny over if all you've earned is what's been necessary for the living expenses of your family. It's only what you can earn in addition to that you have as savings at the end of the year. A careful study that was made showed that the increase in the total national wealth of the United States from 1776 down to the present time, making allowance for inflation, was equal to 5% compound interest. In other words, at the beginning of the year 1776, your net worth was $100 over and above your just debts. At the end of 1776, if you were an average citizen, you should have been worth $105. At the end of 1777, you would be worth $110.25, and so on. During all that time, where could you borrow money at 5% except to gamble on the stock market? Much of the time, loans were obtainable for gambling on the stock market at as low as 1%. But if you wanted it for any constructive purpose, where would you find it at 5%? In other words, the money lenders were taking all the cream and some of the skim milk. If the average of all businesses has only meant an increase in net worth of 5% a year, I think you can safely say that those businesses that were started on wholly or partly borrowed money weren't on the average any more prosperous than the average of businesses in general. Therefore, when you had to start in on borrowed money, paying 6, 7, 8%, when you yourself could only earn 5, what was the result? You'd eventually be driven into bankruptcy, and the lender would take over. So as I say, they were taking all the cream and some of the skim milk too. But that couldn't happen under God's law. Now as to the matter of taxation. The only purpose practically for which modern government exists is to levy taxes upon its unfortunate people. The other functions that they nominally have, they perform rather indifferently. But when it comes to taxation, all the ingenuity and force of the government is devoted to that. You notice that although we are in the midst of a depression, with millions of people out of work and things getting worse, the only remedy that the president's advisors can suggest is to increase taxes. They aren't honest enough to stake their theory completely, but if they are correct, their theory of taxation is this. The solution is to lay such heavy taxes on poverty that nobody can afford to be poor. And I don't think it'll work out that way. Now, it's been a national scandal for many years that many elderly people who have to live on a small fixed income, a little retirement pension, lose their homes because of the heavy property tax they have to pay. That was absolutely forbidden under all circumstances in the laws of God. One tax only was allowed under God's law. Numbers 18, verses 20 to 30. And Yahweh spoke unto Aaron, Thou shalt have no inheritance in their land, neither shalt thou have any part among them. I am their part and thine inheritance, among the children of Israel. There actually were 13 tribes because Joseph, see, was split into two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, which made 13 altogether. But of the tribes who were assigned landed areas where they could have their farms and all be together, that left only 12 tribes because the tribe of Levi were not allowed to have farmlands. Why? Any of you who have tried farming know that it's a full-time occupation from dawn till dark. Now, the Levites had lots of things to do. Twice during the year, they served for a week at the temple. Then they went back to their homes, and at their homes, they were the entire civil service of the nation. They were the teachers, the judges, the administrators, and in general, every public service that was rendered by the government was rendered by the Levites. Now, a farmer just couldn't neglect his farm to take care of that. Everybody who had, he had a little lawsuit against his neighbor. He could come to the local Levite and ask judgment. farmer couldn't attend to that with everybody in the neighborhood running to him every time they had a neighborhood quarrel. The Levites were each given a home in a city, plus enough garden space that he could raise enough for his own table, but not to go into the business of farming. So God says Aaron was the chief representative of the tribe of Levi. You shall have no inheritance in their land. And behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance for their service which they serve. But the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer as a heave offering unto Yahweh, I have given to the Levites to inherit. When ye take of the children of Israel the tithes which I have given you for inheritance, then ye shall offer up an heave offering of it for Yahweh, even a tenth of the tithe, and ye shall give thereof Yahweh's heave offering to Aaron the priest. So, the entire nation paid a tax of 10% to the tribe of Levi, and the tribe of Levi paid a tenth of that tenth, or 1% of the total, to the family of Aaron. Now, the family of Aaron were occupied in the special duties of the priesthood at the temple at all times, and they couldn't take time even to raise their own gardens. You had, therefore, a tax to support the Levites, and the Levites having to support the Aaronic priests. In their ignorance, for generations, our clergymen have taught that the Levites were only priests, only clergymen. They haven't read their Bible enough to know that the Levites had the entire administration of government in their hands under God's law. A tax of a tithe, or 10%, but 10% of what? It was only of the increase. A farmer was the only one who got an increase. He planted so much seed, but he got back a great deal more than he planted. He had an increase. And for doing his farm chores, God gave him that increase. But the increase came not from the farmer and what he did. It came from God. God was the one who caused every plant to give back more seed than you started with. And God was the one who caused the farm animals to multiply. Now, what about a man who lived in the city and was a carpenter? He got some wood and he made a chair out of it. Did he now have more than he started with? No, he had less. Some of his wood was wasted in sawdust and shavings and small pieces that weren't good for anything. He didn't have any real increase. It became necessary later to meet that sort of a case on a money basis. The farmer measured his increase in the fact that he had planted so many bushels of grain and he harvested so many more. He started with 111 sheep and he now had 168, and that sort of thing. For the man who worked with his hands, or did some kind of professional work outside of the Levites, his increase had to be measured in terms of money. It took a bookkeeping operation. But he was not really exempt from the tax. Now, a lot of the professional work was done by the Levites, and their tithe they collected from the people, that was regarded in the same light as the produce of a farm, and they did pay a tithe of their tithe to the Aaronic priesthood. Well, it was simple enough to determine what the net income, the net increase was. It didn't mean that at the end of the year you had 138 sheep, and so 138 sheep were your increase. You had started with a smaller flock, and the amount to which that increased was the only thing that was subject to taxation. Now, the perfect justice of it is plain. in a good year, when you were prosperous, it didn't hurt you to pay a little more tax with your tithe. And the Levites and the poor who were taken care of on a similar basis were entitled to share in that prosperity. In a year of depression, when there were drought and insect plagues and crops were poor and everybody was poor, they couldn't say, like they're saying today, well, raise the taxes that the poor people have to pay. Your taxes went down because your increase wasn't as much as usual. So everybody shared alike in the prosperity or the poverty, as the case might be, of the different years. In return for the tithe they got, all the services rendered by the Levites was rendered free. As it stands, when you want public service, you go to the county clerk and you ask to file a document and he charges you a fee for it. You go to the recorder's office and you ask a copy of something there, he charges you a fee for it. You still get some services free. When your house catches fire, the fire department doesn't make you pay up before they put out the fire. But we have departed in a good deal from the laws of God standard that these services are free and paid out of the tithe. In developing new land, you've got to clear out the stones and that sort of thing and cultivate it and plant trees and so on, and you're not immediately getting a normal yield from new land. And in fact, if you can get enough crop out of it to barely support your family, you're doing well. So the rule was that in developing new land, you paid no tithe until the third year. The first 2 years you got along all right. As to fruit trees, the rule was, it was part of the agricultural law, but it applied to the tithing law as well. For the first 3 years after you had planted a tree, you could not allow any fruit to form on it. You had to go around and pinch off every bud as it formed. The fourth year, you could allow a crop to grow on the tree, but you couldn't have any of it for yourself. All that had to be given to the temple. It formed part of your tithe. The fifth year and thereafter, you could have that, and you paid only a tithe of the crop from then on. I saw the wisdom of that demonstrated by actual practice. Some years ago, a friend of mine bought some land in Escondido, and his neighbor on the adjoining piece of land set out orange trees the same year. Now, they were on the same side of the same hill. They had the same exposure to sunlight and rain and so on, the same sort of soil. Nothing but a wire fence separated the two. His neighbor tried to coax every possible orange off of these trees from the time they were the size of weeds. My friend followed the Bible rule and didn't allow any fruit to form the first 3 years. I saw these two orchards at the time when the fourth year crop was forming. The neighbor's trees were small with little weak spindly branches. They didn't have very much of a crop, but under every branch was a board prop, so it wouldn't be broken by the weight of the few fruit on it. My friend's trees looked as though they were at least double the age of the neighbor's. They were big, healthy trees with thick, strong branches. At least double the crop was on my friend's trees, and there wasn't a prop under any branch, and they didn't need it. For 3 years, the whole strength of that tree had gone into good, sound, sturdy growth. Then when it was ready to start bearing the crop, you had a big tree bearing a big crop. We're always greedier than God, and that makes us think we're wiser than He. But if we would only recognize it, He knows more of what He's talking about than we do. Every third year, there was an additional tithe levied for the poor, the widow, the orphan, and the poor. In other words, this covered all public charity. All the expenses of government proper were paid by the regular tithe. The one-third of a tithe every year, or tithe every third year, covered all public charities. Then the Bible mentions one more tithe of 10%, but this you didn't spend on anybody but yourself and your family. You remember the Bible said that three times in the year, every family must appear before the tabernacle or temple, in the place where God would decide to put it. First, at the Feast of Passover and Unleavened Bread. Second, at the Feast of Weeks, or as we call it now, Pentecost. And third, at the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, except for people who lived in the immediate vicinity, that took them away from home. Now, God didn't want people grumbling. It's a hardship on us to ask us to go to these three feasts. Here we are. I don't want to spend any money beyond the minimum on that, and so we're getting along poorly at these feasts. So the law said that one-tenth you should spend upon your family at these feasts. If you live nearby and you could haul your own wheat for bread and bring along a calf to slaughter for meat and that sort of thing, okay. If you lived so far away that wasn't convenient, then you were to sell enough, a tenth, a tithe, and turn it into money, and take that with you so that at the feast you could buy whatever you need. But you were to have a good time, you and your family, you were to live high for those few days. One tithe for the tax. The tithe you spent on your own family couldn't be counted as a tax. One tithe to the Levites for tax. A third of a tithe for public charity meant you averaged paying 13 1/3% of your net income. That was all. The total taxes we're paying in the United States today, federal, state, and local, are estimated to be about 35% of the gross national product. In other words, we are paying practically three times what we would pay if the laws of God were in effect. And the only thing our bureaucrats can think of to do is to raise the taxes. No nation in history has ever survived very long when taxation passed the 30% mark, and we're already up to 35%. You can see how God's laws were designed for the general prosperity, and not for a few to crookedly make a big profit at the expense of the rest. A legitimate profit God never frowned upon. In fact, prosperity was one of the things he promised our people if we would follow his law. Not that you would have a few billionaires and a few hundred more millionaires and 200 odd million poor people, but you would have general national prosperity. And, being prosperous, you are not to allow the poor to suffer hardship. In Isaiah, where you find so much of what's in the Bible, Isaiah 58, verses 6 to 10. Is not this the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, and that ye break every yoke. Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out to thy house, when thou seest the naked, that thou cover him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh. Then shall thy light break forth as the morning, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee, and the glory of Yahweh shall be thy rear guard. Then shalt thou call, and Yahweh shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, Here I am. If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke, the putting forth of the finger and speaking falsehood, and if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall thy light rise in obscurity, and thy darkness be at the noon as the noonday. As Christ said, he didn't come to change any of this. He came to see that it was fulfilled. Do you remember in the 25th chapter of Matthew, Christ gives the parable of the judgment of the sheep and the goats. He said that when he comes back to bring judgment upon the world, there will be gathered before him all nations, and he will separate them as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And the goats he will put on his left hand, and the sheep he will put on his right hand. And then he will say to those on his right hand, "Come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from before the foundation of the world." He will say, "This is because when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. When I had no place to go, you took me in. When I was in prison, you visited me," and so on. They will say, "Well, Lord, when did we ever do this for you?" And I will say, "Because ye did it to the least of one of these, my brethren, ye did it unto me." Then to the goats he will say, "Depart, ye cursed, into the lake of fire, the place prepared for the devil and his angels. Because when I was hungry, you didn't feed me. When I was thirsty, you didn't give me to drink. When I was naked, you didn't clothe me. When I was cast out, you didn't give me shelter," and so on. And they'll say, "Well, when did we ever see you hungry and fail to feed you?" And so on. And he will tell them, "Because you didn't do it to the least of one of these, my brethren, you didn't do it to me." So the standard under the Old Testament and under the New Testament is the same. Now you remember God promised Israel great prosperity. But that promise was conditional upon our fulfilling his laws. Today, a few people have great prosperity. In fact, they have all the prosperity of the nation as a whole. But the bulk of the people don't have it because we don't follow the laws of God. Now, the economics of God's laws is absolutely sound. The economics of our way is absolutely false. We won't follow God's law and get the benefit because we're too greedy. So we follow Satan's laws and pay the penalty. When will we wake up? As far as I can see from Scripture, we won't wake up. We will obey God's laws when it's crammed down our throat, and not otherwise, because we're too greedy to do it voluntarily.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a CD of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.